Hi, I'm Renata Bernardi, and this is the Job Hunting Podcast, where I interview experts and professionals and discuss issues that are important for job hunters and those who are working to advance their careers. So make sure that you subscribe and follow, and let's dive right in. This episode today is about executive presence, which, by the way, is the most searchable thing on my podcast. People love executive presence. Every time I talk about it or I do an episode about it, it does really, really well. So I'm really excited about having two experts with me this time because it's usually just me talking about it myself. So today I'm joined by Dr. Alexa Chilcutt. Did I pronounce it correctly?
You did.
Okay, and Dr. Carl Dupont. Did I say that correctly?
Oui.
Oui, that's very French. So Alexa and Carl, thank you for joining me and my listeners today. I want, before I pass the ball to you, I want to talk a little bit about you and why you're here. I loved that you reached out because that interdisciplinary approach that both of you have on executive presence, but leadership development and voice and tone and combining the science with the performance that we need to have when we are executives is like so unique and so refreshing to see. You have authored this book, The Presence Principle, Embodying Executive Presence to Lead with Impact. And I will put a link below so people can go and purchase this book. And you both work with leaders and organizations and you teach. And that research-backed skills that translates into real-world impact for my listeners is what we're looking for. I want people that have, you know, the DNA to actually talk about this with expertise and confidence. Alexa, you are an executive coach and you work at Johns Hopkins and you're the faculty lead for the Carey Business School's Executive Education Business Communication Certificate. So if anybody is interested in professional development, go have a look at that program because it sounds great. And Carl, you work in this interesting intersection. I want to hear more about it. Of voice, embodiment, and leadership presence. I love that. And you're an associate professor of voice at Johns Hopkins University's Peabody Institute. I had never heard of that title before. I'm sort of fascinated by it. And the executive education faculty at Johns Hopkins Carey Business School. You teach there as well.
Yes.
Did I say everything right? Because there was so much in the bios. I'm just picking up the things that I think are more relevant.
Sure.
So one of the things that is very interesting is that the founder of our university, his first name was Johns. So it's Johns Hopkins.
Yes. Johns. And I forget to say the S.
Yes. You were so close. It was just that one tiny detail. But that is what Alexa and I do. We focus on those small things so that we can make them better.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for that.
And we both, so Carl and I very much have kind of different backgrounds, obviously, but we came together because we started teaching for a Fortune 200 company in an innovative leadership program where they were really kind of helping to equip their mid-level leaders to be able to rise to more senior-level positions. And they asked us to teach a kind of a day on executive presence. This was years ago. And so Carl and I were like, let's figure that out. And since then, it resonated with people. And it was something that was really powerful that we were surprised by when we taught them. And so since then, we developed a 3-day course at Johns Hopkins and have been teaching that multiple times a year and to corporations. And then that's kind of where we were like, at the end of the class, people always want to know, what's next? What resources can I have? And that's really what kind of came about with our book. We created that so that people would have that continuous resource for themselves.
I love that. I think, you know, this conversation is important for my listeners, but it's also important for me. I am a very pragmatic coach. I work with people that are between jobs and want a better job. And I work with people that want to take more control of their careers. And we always end up talking about executive presence. Mm. Every consultation that I have with my clients, every private coaching client, group client, we're talking about executive presence and how that translates for them. And my biggest challenge is to convince them that there is not a single mold, right? So I want to talk to you about this executive presence definition that exists in rooms that are biased, in cultures that weren't built for maybe the sort of leader that you are. You know, maybe you're a blue collar leader, maybe you come from a different country, maybe you have an accent, maybe all of those things that might interfere with your assumption of executive presence and other people's assumptions of executive presence and their expectations. So what should be adapted, if anything, and what should remain unique?
One of the interesting things from the communication studies science is that one cannot not communicate. At any time when we are in proximity to another person, we are communicating. So that means even before you speak, your actions are being interpreted. And that can be your body language. That can be the tone of voice more so than the words. We understand that only 13% of what's understood is from what you say. So there's this rich range of communication that's happening. When it comes to entering into those situations where you might encounter a different culture, if you haven't taken stock and done inventory of who you are, what your values are, and why you're in the room, and instead you're focusing on those things that bring you anxiety, that's going to read as well. And so Alexa and I designed this book to give the reader multiple opportunities to do the deep dive so that you know exactly what you bring to the table. And so you could put that at the front of the conversation and you can continue to guide the conversation to what's important to you. And I think that cuts across cultural differences.
Mm. Alexa, do you have anything to add?
You know, you said something a moment ago where it was, you know, either other people have a perception of executive presence or you perceive that they have a different perception. And Carl and I both coach as well. And it's so interesting to work with people because so many times they are doing mental gymnastics about assumptions, about ways that people are perceiving them that may not be the case. And so as Carl said, really kind of doing the work to think about, okay, what are my strengths? What are my values? What am I bringing to the table? Feeling good about that, confident, understanding who you are, you know, that comes through. I think that shines through in any culture. And a lot of times people do perceive roadblocks that might not be there and that don't allow them to shine the way that they can shine.
And I think that that's the great thing about working with a coach, because people listening today, they might sort of understand intellectually everything that we're saying here, but then applying it is so hard, right? It's that idea of the rider and the elephant. You know where you need to go. It's just so hard to guide you there. And, you know, I'm assuming both of you have great tasks and work and homework and things that you can teach your clients. I do sort of have my own techniques as well, but I love learning from you. What do you say? And this is something that I think came out late last year. Correct me if I'm wrong. But a very influential person in sort of my clientele, like my clients love Brené Brown. I'm assuming your clients love Brené Brown, right?
We all love Brené.
Everybody does.
We love Brené Brown.
Of course.
Of course I love her. Having said that, she said something quite controversial to me, at least, about executive presence. Would you like to elaborate on what she said and what you think about it?
Well, and Carl, you can piggyback. one of the things that, and she was talking to Adam Grant at the time, and so they were having this kind of conversation, and then it turned into executive presence somehow, and they both kind of talked about how it's an outdated concept, and that it's a very masculine concept, and that we don't need executive presence anymore. And I think that, so we all have this old idea of executive presence. And it, to me, it kind of looks like that series, remember that TV series, Mad Men? That's kind of the outdated idea of executive presence, but that's not today's executive presence. And so it bothered me because I was like, well, you're not really doing people a service by making them feel like that's not something that is achievable or that can be authentic to who they are. And by the way, research shows that executive presence is absolutely the perception of someone's executive presence directly contributes to their career advancement. And the perceived lack of executive presence holds people back. And I can cite the statistics, I can do all the things, but we know that. So yeah, there's a little bit of conflict there.
Okay. And, what about you, Carl?
Well, I'll go back to a thing you mentioned just a second ago about coaching. And I am watching the Winter Olympics right now, and I'm watching the greatest athletes in the world have a coach right there, cheering them on and or consoling them when they fall. And I think that is so inspirational to think that these are athletes that train every day in the roughest conditions, and they need somebody there to make sure that they do their best. And I think it's the same for us in this business.
Mm.
One of the things that I noticed when I was watching this clip of Brené Brown and Adam Grant speak was that she said the science is unclear. And I think that there is such a wide range of science to utilize for executive presence. And that's what you'll notice in the book that Alexa and I wrote. Every single chapter starts with a statistic from research. It's very quantifiable how impressions are made. It's quantifiable how voices are perceived. And it's quantifiable how body language or even attire can contribute or change perceptions as you go into the room. And so I think with Alexa and myself defining executive presence through the psychological resources and research and business research, we're finding a way to take our interdisciplinary skills and make them coalesce to help people put together the many different pieces that it takes to live a successful corporate life.
Yeah, I love what you said. And I mean, my information for now is anecdotal. I've been trying so hard to publish with my colleagues at Monash University where I teach, but they're too busy with other big projects and I'm too small for them. But I have like this nice sample, which, I mean, if you want to use it, I'd love to share with you. My clients are all over the world and they all have similar problems because they're all similar age and stage of their careers. They're all 40 and above. I'm very certain that the listenership for the podcast is the same because that's what pipelines my clients, right? So I get clients from the podcast. And executive presence has transformed in different ways that I think maybe Brené Brown wasn't able to explain, or maybe, you know, it's not part of her repertoire of things that she has focused her attention on, because frankly, she hasn't been looking for work for quite some time. That's right. But look, I think that if you have been in a room with other people and or even virtually in a Zoom or a Teams job interview, you know that there is a certain expectation about how you present for the job that you want. And it has to do, like you said, with your tone and your attire and your level of courage and comfort in answering questions. But frankly, this morning, before catching up with you, I told one of my clients, your blank wall will not help you get that intellectual job in ESG consulting that you want. Your homework is to go to IKEA, buy two bookcases and fill them with all of your books. Because I know you have those books. Where are they?
And we know you're going to read. So
when this thing about the bookcase started and I started sharing videos about this, my mom FaceTimed me and she had like her Kindle behind her. And she's like, oh, this is my Kindle. It has lots of books behind it.
Oh, that's funny.
And I said, Mom, that won't work. That won't work. And I think that those sort of cues, you know, from the way you use technology, the way that you, you know, have your room set up in your hybrid home office, the way that you walk into a conversation and feel that it's peer to peer, it's not servant to leader, right? All of that intentionality of how you present yourself is so important.
Well, mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's beautiful about being on this side of 40 and then 50 and 60 is that you've probably at this point, at some point at time, been on the other side of the table. You've been the one interviewing someone. You've been the one hiring someone. And so just using that little bit of experience, once you're on the other side of the table, you realize, oh my God, I was thinking about all the wrong things. When I was on there doing the interview, and for me as a singer, when I was out there auditioning, I was like, okay, I got to go in. I got to impress them. I got to sing higher, faster, louder. I got to be showier. And right now we're doing auditions at Peabody for the next cohort. And we just want you to communicate from your heart. You can't really impress the jury or the judges. They've seen everything. They've been everywhere. They know it all. And same thing when you're going into these companies, they know the job, they know the description. You can't really impress them in that sense. But if you are, and I'll use Brené Brown, like daring to be vulnerable and show what's important to you, showing what your virtues are, showing what your values are, and then being able to prove it with concrete experiences or examples of how you've made that how you've operationalized that in your career, well, that leaves an impression. That mm-hmm. leaves a mark. And that also allows for the big thing, which is connection. And that's hard to get nowadays, especially with AI. So it really opens up a channel for that human part.
Awesome. Thank you. I have a question for you that I think is a really important one that, again, many of my clients face. And that's showing executive presence, but being afraid of ageism. So you have, let's say, a 55-year-old job candidate being interviewed by a 30-something-year-old HR professional, recruiter, or even the hiring manager. That person will be your manager and they're 20 years younger than you. And that really is something that has made people retire early. I have people in my family that just could not cope. So what would you advise somebody going through that situation to do?
You know, same thing as you. I mean, the people that I coach are 40s, 50s, right? And they're all kind of in that next level, kind of next opportunity thing. I think one of the biggest challenges is that you really need to communicate your agility, that you're a learner, you're a constant learner, you're bringing a wealth of expertise and knowledge that can serve them. And at the same time that you're constantly learning, that you are, right, that you're on the edge of things with them. And so I think the stumbling block sometimes with that 55-year-old and 35-year-old is the perception of outdatedness, right? And so instead, kind of thinking of, this is what I'm bringing to the table. This is what I can offer. And by the way, I'm up to speed. I'm up to date. I see the opportunities within this organization that my expertise could really create different opportunities for, you know, innovation, strategy, all of those things. So I think on some level, we've got to communicate a sense of, what am I trying to say? like contemporary-ness? I don't think that's a word.
I think that's a really brilliant way into that conversation, Alexa. And I'm thinking about making it very legible through credentialing. Micro-credentialing is the term that's being bandied about now. You can take a Google course for free and get a credential in a day and have a stamp mark on that credential that is this year. So you have something that shows the agility that Alexa was talking about, and you can make that legible to who's ever reading it as well. So I'm always encouraging my clients to go where their interests are, find some kind of small credential. No, you don't need to go back to school and get another degree, but spend a day showing that you are capable of taking your skills and translating them into something that is contemporary.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and we were all talking about this before we really started recording, but I mean, think about today, and Carl and I are both in executive education at Johns Hopkins, and we have these mid and senior level leaders that fly from all over the world to come to these courses because they're constantly trying to up level just a little bit, right? But I mean, the topic of the day obviously is AI. And there are executive education courses in AI. And so are you kind of up to speed with that? Are you comfortable with, hey, it's about efficiency. It's about maximizing my output and influence. And so right now, that's kind of the topic of the day.
And I'm going to add something to what you said that I think is really important, because you probably work with very senior clients as well. And when I do, and I ask them to do micro-credentials and learn about AI and learn about whatever it is that they need to learn, I tell them, you know what? For your executive presence, you don't actually need to announce to the world that you've done all of these things. What you need to do is to showcase that you know these things. Mm-hmm, yeah. And there's a difference there. I have clients, I have one right now that I'm thinking of. She's really senior, very much an expert in her area and in her field. And she has uploaded all of her certificates into her LinkedIn and made it so sort of obvious that it almost kind of diminishes her executive presence by her need to showcase it. And I've been asking her to please put that down. And instead of doing that, why don't you write an article, a strong article about, there is an article written about AI this week, which made me like, okay, I need to, you know, talk about AI. So I told you before we started recording that I interviewed somebody to address this issue. And it was published on LinkedIn. It wasn't published on the Wall Street Journal. It wasn't published on Forbes or Fortune. It was published on LinkedIn. So you can then showcase your expertise, or the fact that you're learning, you know, if you don't have the expertise yet, you can say, as an executive, I feel the need to learn about AI, and I've done these three courses. This is why I think you should do them too. You don't need to be an expert. You just need to show that you've done it and educate people, your peers, your network, as to why. That shows executive presence, not you announcing that you've done the certification.
Yes, I think that's beautifully said and beautifully explained. It's not executive announcements, it's executive presence.
Show them. There's another type of, I mean, that sort of alienation we feel from being older is one thing. There's another one that is from you having a cultural dissonance with the people that are interviewing you, right? So I felt that a lot when I moved to Australia. Like, Brazil is such a different culture, you know, when it comes to, we are so informal. I remember in my first job being asked to organize things, files alphabetically, and I organized them all by first names, and nobody could figure out, like, what have you done? You haven't organized them. And I'm like, yes, I have. You ask me that again, and I would probably organize that by your nicknames. I mean, look at the Brazilian soccer team. You look at the back, it's everyone's nicknames, right? So we're very casual in the way that we address people and very flat. So sometimes there is that cultural dissonance, even when you move from state to state in America, or when you move countries, or when you move industries or sectors, even if you have a public servant going into corporate, it just doesn't sound right. You know, there's like a weird way that you express yourself that needs, the narrative needs to change. But how do you coach people that have experienced that and want to address it?
Think about this as code switching. And I think about identifying the target language or target culture. So there are very few places on the world where people only speak one language or one dialect. In most places where the borders are imagined, there are so many cultures that are there, and you can move through one or the other. And even when you look at linguistics, they identify in, we know about dialect, but they also identify an idiolect. We all have an individual way of speaking, and then we've got to make ourselves understood wherever we're going. One of the ways to understand what the target language is or what the target culture is by doing a little research and by listening and learning. We retain our adaptability throughout our entire lives as human beings. Now, sometimes we don't utilize it as much as we can, but that adaptability is really our greatest strength. And it allows for that connection piece that I was mentioning earlier. So I encourage clients to think about that target and to do the work and then start doing the translation so that your best self can shine through. Because if you don't speak the language and you kind of cut yourself off, then we don't get to know you and we can't value you in the way that we would like to.
I love that. I love that code switching definition in your book. So much easier than the one I've been using. I use Bertrand Russell's four narrative styles, and that's the names are really difficult.
Yes.
And, you know, that idea of the cultural narrative style where, like, you want to be in that clique where, let's say, if you're a public servant and you're talking to a public servant and you use all this sort of government style wording that nobody in the corporate world would understand, and then you try to translate that in your resume when you're looking for, let's say, a consulting role, and everything sounds weird.
Yeah.
You don't have that, the jargon, the new jargon. So code switching, I love that term.
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of precedent for that. In all of our lives, there's precedent for it. And so we can utilize that as a strength, how I speak at home with my family versus how I speak at work. Versus how I speak when I'm in a new environment and I don't know what's going on first. I listen first and then I determine what it is. So I think that that is a very underutilized skill that we all have.
That's great. And Alexa, you both describe authenticity in a very practical way. And I want people to understand that code switching isn't really sort of taking the authenticity out of you. It's you adapting what you want to say to your audience. It's a really being taking care of that audience, understanding them, being empathetic with them. So where do your professionals most often confuse authenticity with, you know, saying everything, showing everything, and, you know, code switching or putting on a mask? Do you have that problem with your clients?
You know, when we began teaching executive presence, that was really a sticking point for a lot of people. Because, once again, the outdated idea of executive presence. And believe me, when Carl and I began teaching this, what, like 4 years ago? I don't even know now anymore. We had to do research on it. I mean, we had not taught executive presence. We had taught public speaking for professionals and business communication and all of these things. And so we really were digging into it at the same time. And people always got stuck on authenticity. So what we said was, you know, it's not prescriptive. We are not telling you that you need to look a certain way, act a certain way, sound a certain way, right? You are you. And it really is, Carl said this at the beginning, uncovering what your values are, what your strengths are, what you bring to the table, and being comfortable with yourself. One of the things that I love about some of the research that we base our idea of executive presence around, one of the characteristics is confidence, right? Projected confidence. We've always thought of executive presence as projecting confidence. But the way that they defined it based on their research was that it was a sense of self-assuredness, you know, a sense of self, being you could be quiet and introverted and still be confident. And so when we think about, you don't have to be an extrovert, you can be an introvert. You can still project confidence. You can have grace under fire. You can be somebody who walks into a room and sits comfortably and still commands the space. And so it was wrestling with the, we're not trying to make you put on anything. Because if you put something on and it's not you, then you can't maintain it. And the biggest thing we know about executive presence is it's not just about first impressions. It's not just about those initial impressions or short-term impressions. In fact, half of the characteristics involved in executive presence are impressions over time. Things like interpersonal integrity. Do people trust that you are authentically genuine in your relationships? That, right, you're not trying to get to know them and the next day you forget their name. So can they trust you? Do you have the ability to build rapport? Values in action are one of the characteristics. Well, that is over time, right? So what kind of values do you say as a leader you have? And then do people see you demonstrating that over time? Expertise and knowledge, follow through. So we get so confused because we think we're having to put it on when it's really about enacting it. And you can't enact it if you don't have a solid foundation.
I love everything about very long. No, it's a great answer, and that incremental development of your reputation, of your personal brand, for you know, I don't know if you hate or love that word, but you know, for lack of a better word, that is what will keep you top of mind and make you stick in people's consciousness if they need somebody to address a specific problem, and I want them to think of you. You know, that's what I always think when we're developing that sort of concept with my clients, which leads to a sustainable career. If people think of you for your expertise and your presence and your the way that you bring a certain type of energy, you won't do that instantaneously. It will have to be developed over time. Having said that, I have a personal struggle that I want to share with you, and that's kind of comes from my own lived experience. So, you know, I spent some time in the Silicon Valley when I was young because my dad worked there, and I kind of just adopted that style of dressing. So basically, I was a tropical version of Steve Jobs. I used to dress with Teva sandals, Bermudas, and very loose t-shirts. And I had my own business. It was my first business. And I wanted my business to succeed. And it wasn't until I started dressing better that I started succeeding. I'll be honest with you. There was a bit of makeup involved. There was, you know, better shoes and a better way of presenting myself. And then many years later, when I was teaching that to university students looking for graduate roles that were from blue collar backgrounds, indigenous backgrounds here in Australia, and they were really reluctant to put on a suit, I said, well, if you were doing medicine and you said to your academics that you didn't want to wear scrubs, you wouldn't be able to go to a hospital. If you wanted to be a Buddhist monk and you don't want to wear the attire of a Buddhist monk, you wouldn't be able to join them. So I kind of understood much later what needed to happen there. And I wondered what you have to say about that, because that's a personal struggle of mine.
Look, I love talking about appearance. But you know, when you're coaching somebody, you really have to wait for them to open that door. Do you know what I mean? Because it's such a sensitive topic to a lot of people. But just like you said, it's first of all, based on the culture. You're right. The way that you're going to go dressed for a, you know, Wall Street job is not what you're going to go looking like when you go to Apple, you know, the campus. It's a very different thing. But I do believe in thinking about where am I? What is that culture? What are the expectations? And if I want a role, that next level role, well, what do people in that role look like? I mean, it's that old adage of dress for the job that you want, not for the job that you have. And it does matter. And, you know, so I think there are things that we have to, you can have your own style. If you're somebody who loves to wear color, if you, I mean, absolutely embrace your own style, but also have it in balance with what the expectations are for someone in the role that you would like to have. Carl, I know you were going to say something.
I was. There is research from a study in 2020 about attire, and it points to the fact that nonconformity at times, you're mentioning Silicon Valley, that can be an added benefit in particular realms. So if you want to show charisma and that is your target, then go ahead and explore what nonconformity is. If you want to show what Alexa was talking about, which is understanding the culture, being a part of the culture, then you can also choose to enact that with your attire. I come from a background of the stage, and I love putting on a costume. For me, there is nothing more freeing. Give me a wig, give me a robe, give me a crown. And now,
Carl, where's your costume? Why aren't you dressed up today?
I want a crown.
This is my costume for today. This is my business costume. So, because then you can play. When we realize that, as Alexa always brings this quote up, all the world's a stage, and we realize that this is a costume, whether it comes from our family culture or where it comes from corporate culture, it's a costume no matter what. Because I think even in this age in 2026, I think we're all still born naked. Is that correct?
I think so, pretty much.
So no matter what, it's a costume. And I embrace that as a way to start playing, to fill the character. And if you use that, all the world's a stage, I think it makes it a little easier to find the right costume for the right role.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that... So what I do, and I'd love for you to sort of critique me if you sort of have issues with it. If a client has something that they are bringing into a room and a conversation, old conversation where their expertise is unknown and they need to showcase their expertise in order to get a job or a promotion or whatever. If they have something different from the expectation, what I tell them to do and I train them to do is to make that part of their narrative. You know, bring the elephant into the room with them and address that. I don't want them to walk out of the room and have people talking about them without them in the room. I want that, you know. So yesterday I was telling a client of mine about a student back in the day when I still worked with graduates that used to have very beautiful but heavy makeup, Indian makeup. This was back in 2010. And back then, you know, I thought that would be an issue to get her a job. And she was so smart. And I did talk to her about it. And she said, no, this is my heritage. I want to, you know, use this makeup in my interviews. And I said, well, then let's incorporate that into your introduction. Let's incorporate that into your conversation. The elephant is in the room and you need to make them remember that they have a diversity and inclusion policy, that they want different people in their teams and not everybody looks the same at a consulting company. She got the job. She's now working in the UK in a really high profile role in a big consulting organization. I'm so proud of her that she did not, you know, took my advice, and instead I actually had to adapt what I was telling her to do, and it worked. So since then, I've been doing that with my clients on the spectrum, with my clients on, you know, that have my queer clients. All of the things that are different are brought into the narrative.
I think about that. I've encountered what this situation that you're talking about in many different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, with the intersectionality of my identity and then all of what I bring. And it took me so long to realize that if they didn't want me there, I didn't want to be there.
Yes, absolutely.
And so when you bring your full self, just like this client that you're talking, you really are underlining the fact that you're interviewing them as well. Are they really going to be able, is this really a place that can see value, can hold value, can be true to their word, can work with a person from a different background? Because if it's not, then that will eventually be a very uncomfortable work environment. And nobody's going to be happy as well. And it'll be their loss because, as you said, this was a brilliant client and a brilliant person.
Yeah.
So that took me so long to understand. It took a lot of rejection and hurt. And it has really started clicking, and it's made me just thrilled for the spaces where I am welcomed and I embraced, and I can do my best work in that way.
Awesome. Carl, I'd love to ask you about voice as well, because I'm so, so interested in this, and I know nothing. So I really want to know more. What do you think are the common voice issues that get misread as low confidence in interviews, or, you know, a lack of executive presence because of voice or tone or accent? I'd love to hear your views on that.
Well, when I think of something that I want to talk about with voice, one thing that always comes to mind is people who talk monotone and who talk in a run-on sentence without any kind of grammar and just go on and use a lot of filler words. So
yeah,
it's the tone, it's the pitch. We are a species of storytellers. And one of the things I ask my clients to do is whenever I catch someone just getting up there speaking, and these are the most brilliant people, right? We work with engineers, we work with scientists. Johns Hopkins is a research university. So someone will be up there talking about something, their life-changing, world-saving research, and they'll speak about it just like this in a monotone. And I'm like, no, this work is too important. You have to tell a story, and imagine that you are telling this story to a four-year-old. How would you talk about it? Now, of course, we let the pendulum swing all the way over there, and then we titrate to get it to where it's appropriate for an interview or a presentation at a conference. But it's got to be about the story with the voice. And I guarantee that person who is speaking without taking a breath. Oh, that's a big one, Renata. People get up there and think they don't have to breathe anymore. Or someone that is speaking without punctuation, they forget about their periods and commas. If you put that same person in a room where they are reading a story to a four-year-old or telling a story to their friends, they're going to be animated and they're going to be able to use the three that I talk about often, which would be pitch, volume, and rhythm. They're going to be able to implement those. And so I like to help people just see, oh, these are the strengths that you already have. This is how you communicate when you are really passionate about something and you want to get a message across. What if you took those skills and put that here in the corporate environment? And then my job as a coach is to make it safe for them to do that, because oftentimes there is some underlying sense of anxiety that is preventing them from having the full range of expression.
Yes, yes. And And that, and by the way, you know, and in case you're worried, because sometimes I talk to people and they're like, oh, not everybody who is on the spectrum should, you know, disclose that in an interview. That is a conversation that many people have with me if they come for a 1 hour consultation and they want to know, should I disclose? It usually is if they cannot fix that. If their, you know, autism is such where their monotone cannot be fixed. So then we work on how we're going to address that in the interview and own our narrative and the way that we present. So I remember with one client, it was about, okay, what will make you more comfortable? If I could bring my visual aids, you know, my maps and my projects. Yes, bring Absolutely. It. Let Yeah. them know that you need that. And then, I mean, I have CEOs on the spectrum that have worked with Sure. me.
Of course.
So, you know, and yeah.
Because they're brilliant. And
all of that. And you know, people with some sort of disability as well and some sort of, you know, things that are outside of the normative sort of executive presence way of thinking. And I kind of think that is important for people to know that if you tell me you're on the spectrum, but we can manage without letting people know and you don't feel comfortable letting people know, well, yeah, let's work with that. But if we cannot, then that's how we sort of workshop different ideas. The other thing that I think is interesting, and I'm happy for either of you to address, is the fact that you can tell I'm a woman and I talk like nonstop. I can talk underwater. Like I have to really pace myself, especially if I'm in an interview, not to waffle too much and not to say too many words and not to go on and on and on and on. That is another sign of, I mean, it can signify nervousness, anxiety, a bit of stress. Mm-hmm. For me, it's excitement because I love talking to you both. So, you know, I kind of tend to talk more than I should. Do you sort of have a recipe to fix me? Because I would love that. I do. I need to stop talking, you guys.
No, I mean, I think part of it is always preparation, which you've done, right? We kind of have here's kind of some questions we're going to address. And, you know, I think you are good at reading the room. And you might, I think all of us at different times in this podcast were like, wow, I just said a mouthful. I mean, maybe. So I think that's just normal on some level. But when you're in spaces, one of the things that I tell clients is if you're, let's say, in an interview and you're worried about running on and on, you know that maybe one of the questions is going to be, why do you believe that you're a good fit for this position? You have all of these things that you want to talk about. In your preparation, this is a trick that Carl and I learned from another book, but we've implemented it and we've coached it to everybody else and everybody, like, it's a thing because it really is the rule of three. If you can do preparation where you say, well, you know, there are three aspects about my experience that directly relate to this position. You're giving yourself a framework for that answer. There's a beginning. And there's an end. One, two, three. You're also communicating to the other person that you're an organized thinker. So automatically at the beginning of answering that question, you know, and we also teach that nonverbal communication is also in the silence. So if someone asks you a question in an interview, or maybe at the end of a presentation, you've got a great job. You have to get up and give presentations. Everybody is always afraid of those questions at the end. Have someone ask the question, raise your eyebrows, count to one or two, three in your head, and then answer. Well, you know, there are three ways I would do that. But that kind of rule of three gives some organization and, like I said, a cutoff place.
And one of the things that's tough with the cutoff place is being okay not saying everything you know.
Mm.
Because the clients sometimes are like, oh, well, I have this thing to say and this thing to say. And if I slow down, they'll cut me off. And I say, what's the worst that could happen? if you say three things like Alexa was talking about and you don't say six things, what is the worst that could happen? And so exploring that to allow the brain and the body to feel a sense of safety with saying three things and then stopping talking is an important part of embodying that.
I love that. I love that. And I'm guilty of that. I need to sort of work on that with my therapist or something. And I can see that being something that for an anxious job seeker, you know, somebody who really, really needs a job, they may think that more is more when in fact more is less, right? Mm-hmm. Because then you don't have an anchor to hold on to as a somebody who needs to make a decision to remember that person by, because you, that person sort of pulverized you with so many ideas that it's, you know, it's hard for you to remember them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the three is a memory device. Mm-hmm. So when you're giving a speech, when you're giving a presentation, if you have three main points, if you're opening a meeting and you say, we're going to do three things today. We're going to discuss this new policy. We're going to make a decision about such and such, and we're going to figure out next steps. People are more engaged because they feel like there's a roadmap. And because they're engaged and there's a roadmap, they're going to follow you more. They're not going to tune out, and they're going to take away more. So like you said, instead of the 6, 10, 12 things, having three gives you that anchor, exactly what you said. And it is going to help that listener remember more. So we call it cherry pick. Think about, I have this much information I really want to share. But if I were to boil it down to the most important things or the things that I want people to walk away with, what would those three things be?
Exactly. That sounds pretty good. And I want to finish off with this question for you, because one of the easy ways to potentially diagnose somebody as not having the executive presence that they need to achieve their goals is when they come to us and they are technically brilliant, very good at what they do. They should be an easy pick for an interview or for a final offer. But they keep hearing, you're not senior enough. You don't have that right experience that we were expecting. And I'm not saying that every time this happens, it is about executive presence, but that's kind of, you know, something that sort of is a proxy, can act as a proxy. And then you can interrogate a little bit more to find out if that's the case. I want you to tell us a time when you've worked with a candidate that had that situation and what happened that you were able to fix it.
Okay. Off the bat, I can think of, I was just having this conversation with someone else. I'm working with several people at the moment, from one large corporation and then just some other clients kind of through Johns Hopkins. And they're all kind of would fit into that category on some, many of them would. But they have many of the same issues. And so I go from one person to the next and I'm like, I just heard this, right? And so I'll tell you two. Number one is they have been given a seat at tables at meetings with larger groups of executives or leaders, and they're not comfortable sharing their ideas. They self-censor themselves. Well, some other people are talking and I don't know if I should really say this thing and should I take up space? And these are brilliant people. So it's number one, it's sharing, feeling comfortable using your voice and sharing those ideas. Number two, it's about self-advocacy and telling your story. And so we often talk about you're doing fabulous work, but everybody else is so busy thinking about their own work. It's not that they're not trying to recognize yours, but you have to be able to tell the story. And so when you're getting a project update in a meeting, tell a little bit more of the story. You know, well, because I had previously worked on this other project, I'm bringing some of that expertise into this, and it's informing me in this way. It doesn't have to be a novel, right? It can, Carl likes to say, it doesn't have to be a novel. It can be a movie. So... It doesn't have to be a whole long thing, but you have to be able to tell your story, and you have to think about who are the people that are going to be in that room where those decisions are being made. And am I creating the impressions about my leadership through how I talk about my work and how I speak about myself when I have those opportunities? So those are the two things.
Yeah.
Carl?
And I encourage people to explore their inner monologue. What are you saying to yourself in those instances? And we were speaking about confidence a little earlier. It's something that is a practice. And Alexa used the word that we enact. So confidence can be something that you build. It's a muscle, just like attention, just like biceps. So start to listen to that inner voice. Is it cheering you on? And if it's not, then that's an opportunity for you to have executive presence in the boardroom. That's up here, because it starts here. It starts here. Can you find small things that you can say, "Bravo, Carl, you did that really well." And then let that translate and start to radiate through everything that you do. And I guarantee others will start to notice it as well.
Carl, just because very few people watch this on YouTube, I have not been able to crack the code on YouTube yet. So it's embarrassing how few people. You touched your brain and you touched your heart.
Yes.
And I want you to explain which one comes first so that people that are listening on Spotify can figure that out.
Well, just then, I touched my brain first before I touched my heart. I am really interested in the neuroscience of leadership. And that is my current obsession, if you will, and how our brain is designed to get us moving, to keep us safe, and how it influences and connects with and talks to the body on this cellular level. It's really, really fascinating and could probably be a whole other podcast. It's so connected. Our thoughts are not just abstract. They're actually a part of our body, and they live in the body, and they live in the muscles, and they live in the sinews, and they live in the fascia. So it really is important to start to analyze what's happening, and I'm touching my brain again, and how that influences how you feel. And now I'm touching my heart. For all of you in Spotify land.
All right. Look, Alexa and Carl, I feel like I've known you forever. I don't know. I have like the sense of kinship with both of you. Thank you so much for joining me and my listeners on the Job Hunting Podcast. You're always welcome to come back if you have any more books, if you start to developing more ideas about, you know, the neuroscience of leadership. I'd love to hear from you. And yeah, you're now friends of the pod, so come back anytime. Do you have any final thoughts, things that you want people to know, or places where they can find you? Let them know now, and I'll put links below.
Well, I think we encourage people to connect with us on LinkedIn. We're both very responsive and post a lot of, you know, kind of articles and tips and things like that. And then we actually have a website, thepresenceprinciple.com. So, and we will send you the link. You'll have the link to the book and all the good things.
Yeah. And if you connect with me on LinkedIn, just DM me voice and I'll send you a little PDF that I call Tips, Tricks, and Truth to help let your voice resonate throughout the world.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.